this is really a very fundamental issue too, Pam, that you touch on here. And I remember this when we recorded your interview too, that your stance on water, it's so foundational. It's so fundamental. I mean, on one hand, you have some people saying, oh, we got to get, you know, the right mineral balance and minerals in the system and all that. And then on the other side, you have people saying, wait, along with the minerals, you get toxic heavy metals. And, you know, so mm-hmm. it's a real trick to find the path. You know, that's yeah. definitely something for us right now that we're very focused on and interested, because we're getting a lot of people asking us about, okay, what do we do about water, water filtration?
Oh, I know. There's no perfect answer. I will say, I've been invited to go to the World Water Summit in London, England in March that I should be attending. And a very dear friend of mine, Professor Joe Cummins, has done a paper on the pharmaceuticals that are showing up in our water supplies. And so, you know, the trick is, I'm working alongside a scientist here in Southern Ontario who's been testing water. And I can tell you the city water supplies are extremely contaminated. That when the water is coming out of your tap, it's not potable water. It's absolutely filthy. And the cities should be accountable for this. They're selling this water to us as clean and safe water, and it's not clean and safe water. We have taken random samples out of our faucets and tested it, and at very specialized labs. And of course, the government and the cities and the city governments, the provincial governments, and so on, they're ignoring the fact that we're finding, traces of these pharmaceutical drugs, drugs that are given to the factory farm animals. You know, we're seeing excess amounts, unacceptably high levels of lead in the water, arsenic, of course. We're seeing so many toxins in the water beyond their acceptable levels. Of course, there shouldn't be any, ideally, any of these metals, heavy metals in the water, but they're showing up. And yeah. I work, as you know, on the fluoride issue, and I know this has come up over the course of the week, so I don't want to repeat anything that's probably already been said, but this one scientist that I know here in Ontario has said that if we could just get artificial water fluoridation out of our water, that this would indeed clean up the water by about 50%, because yeah. fluoride just loves to attach on to certain metals, right?
Yeah. So. There's actually, I remember when I was interviewing David Kennedy, we got to get back. I can talk to you all hour. Shoot, we got to get to these questions. But David Kennedy was talking about how there's a substantial study done that when people live in areas where the water is fluoridated, that there's an increased lead then in that person's system, because the fluoride somehow, and I don't understand the chemistry behind it, but the fluoride kind of volatilizes, if you will, the other metals in the piping heading to the person's home. It's just insane. Mm-hmm. Truly.
Yeah, it loves to attach on to lead. It loves to attach on to, you know, copper. And so if you have lead pipes, it's going to increase your intake of lead. If you have copper pipes, it's going to increase your intake of copper. But added to the insult to injury, of course, is that city water supplies commonly add copper to the water supply to give as an antifungal, and then they add aluminum to the city water supply as, you know, a way to give water that crystal clear look. And of course, sadly enough, these metals overaccumulate in the body and just wreak havoc.
Yeah. Okay. So, question here from Daphne. It says, Pam, how bad is phytic acid in our diet if our diet is also high in animal fats? And please describe the effect it has on our bodies. Also, how effective are soaking methods described by the WAP at reducing it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that's a great question. It's really based on what grain, seed, or so on that you're asking about, because they all have different soaking times in terms of when they're able to break down the phytic acid, and the temperature does play a role as well. So if you do soak, generally what you want is to try and soak in not hot water, but maybe warm water on a kitchen counter. But essentially, you want to break down phytic acid because it can interfere with your body's ability to assimilate minerals. So that's the long and the short answer right there. You know, there's lots of information on the internet. I think it's Amanda Rose has a lot of information. She has a website called Rebuild from Depression, and she shows charts of different legumes or seeds and their soaking times and how much phytic acid has actually broken down after so many hours soaking. And then I think she shows some research where the temperature difference will render different results in the food that is being soaked. So yes, you want, you know, our ancestors knew this information through wisdom. They didn't need scientific labs or graphs or charts. They just knew to soak grains accordingly and possibly ferment them depending on the grain or the recipe that you're using. So I'm not a big fan of grains, nuts, or seeds. I don't myself eat a lot of them, but if I do eat grain, it's usually soaked in the form of something like sourdough bread.
Sure, sure. Okay, let's move on. For Pam as well, some nutritionists say that green leafy vegetables are some of the most nutritious foods. People can even heal from cancers and autoimmune diseases through fresh vegetable juicing along with detoxing. Can you clarify whether we need vegetables as part of a healthy, nourishing diet? Good question.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, it's a great question. I mean, I'm a recovering raw food vegan and used to believe that, you know, vegetables and fruits were very nutrient dense. Unfortunately, I had to learn the hard way that these foods really should be eaten in the diet, but relatively small quantities. So, and I used to work in the green food industry, by the way. Well, I don't know if you know that about me, but I used to work in the green food industry, and I studied under Ann Wigmore, and I used to promote classes and teach classes on how to grow wheatgrass and sprouts and all of these sorts of things. And really, these foods are completely overrated in terms of their nutrient value and health benefits. I know about all the claims that are made around green foods and green drinks and juices. And I have a couple of juicers sitting somewhere in storage somewhere collecting dust, and you know, I'd be happy to give these juicers away. I do not recommend juicing. It's just there's too much risk involved in terms of how much sugar intake somebody may be taking in. We do not want to be spiking our insulin levels, and juicing will do that, just like a Snickers bar might. So, you know, juicing is bad from that perspective. I don't like juicing also because when I'm working with mineral ratios and when I'm trying to get a mineral ratio intact, and that, for example, the sodium and the potassium ratio being the most important mineral ratio, it should be at a ratio of 2.5 to 1. And since we evolved on animal foods, you know, animal foods are high in sodium, low in potassium. Plant-based foods are high in potassium, low in sodium, as a general rule of thumb. So if we're eating concentrated amounts of vegetation, then the risk is you could be competing with the natural ratio of sodium to potassium, high sodium, low potassium, 2.5 to 1. So I don't like juicing as well because of that reason. And then another reason I don't like juicing is because much of the vegetation that's out there really does need some preparation time in order to break down anti-nutrients. And you mentioned one earlier, the phytic acid. There are other anti-nutrients in plants that really need to be broken down from cooking or perhaps lacto-fermentation. And if you're juicing, you're just getting a direct hit of these anti-nutrients. Right. Keep in mind that humans can fight off their enemies. We can scream at our enemies. We can punch them. We can fight off our enemies that way. Plants don't have that luxury. So embedded in a lot of the plants that are out there, you have these anti-nutrients. And these plants do need to be many times cooked or lacto-fermented in order to break down these compounds.
Right.
So I don't like juicing for a variety of reasons. The fourth reason I don't like juicing is because I'm working with people who have debilitating chronic fatigue or depression. And quite honestly, juicing is a chore. It's a lot of work. And they're really tired. My clients are usually very, very tired to begin with. And it's just the thought of cleanup and everything is just too much for them to handle.
Right.
Yeah.
I have if I can touch in on this, obviously I defer to your knowledge because you're the one who studies blood chemistries, and I'm thrilled actually with your work in that field. The reason that some people are able to positively affect their health through a lot of plant material in their diet for a period of time is because plant materials are going to draw down and detox the system. The problem with this inherently is that by detoxing the system, you are removing the good stuff with the toxins in your system that your body's accumulated to create that disease, essentially. And so, you know, I think that there's a balance point here. If a person is going to have some green foods, it surely seems to me that you know, eat them in season. Have some green foods. You know, if you're going to eat a little more green food in the spring when there's more green, you watch the animals. This is what they do. So, you know, you gotta to take something whole hog and say that, well, the, like you said, like the raw food vegan, you know, that's the thing is that an extremist.
Yeah, the thing is one could eat too much vegetation, especially in one sitting.
Right.
And let's say you sit down and eat lots of a big plate of carrots, even if they're cooked, or spinach, or broccoli, or cauliflower. You could still take in too much sugar at once, because remember, sure, these are all sources of sugar. So that's why I say try and limit your carb intake to 72 grams a day. Try not to exceed that, because then you could be risking dysregulating your blood sugar.
Yeah. Do y'all catch that gem there? Did you hear that gem that she just dropped? 72 grams of carbs a day. Got it.
And that's based on the work of Wolfgang Lutz, who wrote the book Life Without Bread. And he, for 40 years as a medical doctor, saw tremendous health improvements in his patients as long as he limited the carb intake to about 72 grams a day.
Perfect.
So I'm not anti-carb at all.
Sure.
I want people eating fruits and vegetables. I just don't like to see people eat excessive amounts of fruits and vegetables, because that's what I did and it backfired on me. And the same thing can go with juicing, because if you think about the amount of juice that is sitting in a carrot juice or whatever, there's a lot of sugar in there, and you want to make sure that you're not spiking your insulin.
Yeah.
And that's another dark side to doing that.
Absolutely.
And all the other reasons I talked about as well. So absolutely enjoy your greens. But you know, most of those greens probably should be cooked. And another side point to that is that when I'm working with people who have debilitating chronic fatigue, depression, and so on, they usually have very weak digestive systems.
Mm-hmm.
So they don't do very well on, a lot of cellulose.
Sure.
In the diet. So they really do need their vegetables cooked. So I don't recommend a lot of raw vegetables, for example.
Yep.
And some people, even when you talk about fruit berries, or you know, a small amount of berries are fine. But if you're talking about something like an apple, and you know somebody with weak digestion eats an apple, very commonly it can go right through them. It can be very difficult on the digestive system, especially in somebody who's sick. And somebody who has a healthy digestive system won't understand a word I just said, because they're like, what do you mean you can't digest an apple? Well,
right,
there are people out there that can't.
Right. So
yeah.
Great question for you here, Pam. A couple of them, and they're all connected to this whole biochemical understanding that you have. This lady from Adrian says here, I'm missing my gallbladder. What would you suggest for that? She thinks it's playing a big role in her tooth decay and preventing healing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, the gallbladder is one of the main things I work on in terms of helping people get their biochemistry back. Having a gallbladder removed isn't the end of the world. You can work around it. I mean, the gallbladder is simply a sac, a container for the bile. So, as long as you're still producing bile and the bile is still being able to find where it needs to go into the small intestine, you should still be able to properly assimilate your fats and minerals and so on. But the key thing is to make sure you're producing the bile in the first place. And that's where the coffee enemas are very, very helpful. That's where it's very important to eat a lot of foods that support bile, that help to thin bile. Things like, you know, sipping on lemon through the day, or, using things like apple cider vinegar, for example. Some people take things like taurine as well to help support the liver and the gallbladder. There's lots of things that you can do to support bile production. But, Will, the trick is, when somebody has a gallbladder removed, that doesn't remove the problem, all right? It doesn't remove, number one, whether the individual is producing enough bile in the first place. Secondly, whether or not that bile can actually descend and go where it needs to go into the small intestine.
Mm.
So it could be blocked by gallstones. And invariably, there's going to be hundreds of gallstones in the way. And when the doctors go in and do the surgery, they're not looking in through the bile duct system necessarily to see where these gallstones are. And then secondly, of course, even they don't really ever think about the fact that the gallstones are potentially blocking the highway system of bile ducts in there. So a liver gallbladder flush can be very, very helpful as well in terms of being able to, or trying to explode out those gallstones. But that can take a tremendous amount of support and guidance to do the liver gallbladder flush.
Right, right.
Yeah, because it can trigger a gallbladder attack in some individuals. I know this individual doesn't have a gallbladder, right. But it still can contribute a lot of discomfort. The liver gallbladder flush is sometimes not very simple to do for some people. For some people, it's a breeze, but for other people, it can be a complete nightmare. They may be up vomiting all night. You know, they're on the toilet all day the next day. It's not an easy thing to do. So be prepared mentally, physically, if you are going to do something like that.
Right, right. I mean, and definitely get the help of somebody like Pam to be your coach so that you can go, Pam, this is going on. And she can say, look, it's normal. It's all right. You know, do this and it'll help.
Oh, some of my clients send me pictures of their gallstones. So.
Oh, my gosh. Oh, the beauties of the business. Okay, so here's a question from Jenny. Do you advise that people with low cortisol levels during the day take an adrenal cortex supplements, and what are the problems associated with the supplement alone, along with following proper nutrition?
Yeah, I don't typically recommend an adrenal glandular. I don't see a lot of success in using adrenal glandulars. It really depends on somebody's biochemistry. And so I don't know the answer to that question until I see somebody's biochemistry. And then I know whether or not they might be able to handle an adrenal glandular or not. But even at that, I rarely ever use adrenal glandulars just because I just don't see them being very effective. So Right. It's very difficult to get the adrenals turned back on again. Mm-hmm. It has to do with the mineral ratios. The mineral ratios have to be in a very specific profile. And they're your light switches. They're what's going to turn your adrenal glands on, and same thing with your thyroid gland. You know, the adrenals need to be in their correct positions so that they turn things on. So it's not as simple as saying, I have weak adrenals, I'm going to take an adrenal glandular, right? Your typical protocols for when people have chronic fatigue or burnout are going to be things like an adrenal glandular, a B-complex, zinc, magnesium, things like that, high-dose vitamin C. And I really don't recommend those protocols. Number one, because I don't see them working in the long run. And number two, because people are taking these supplements blindly and don't necessarily understand the impact that these nutrients will have on their biochemistry. Some people can handle a B-complex, other people can't. It really depends on where their biochemistry is sitting.
Right. So, I mean, again, taking these broad brushstroke ideas of, you know, vitamin C is good for us, or taking a B-complex is good for us, or whatever, it really comes down to, we need a feedback tool. And you're one of these people who looks at our biochemistry, our blood analysis, our mineral analysis, to be able to see what's really going on there. It's a fascinating whole theory. You know, the whole thing is incredible to me.
Yeah, I mean, I love what I do, but I honestly rarely ever talk about it. And it's simply because it's a whole different way to look at health. I'm looking deep under the hood of the car to see what's going wrong. Right. I'm not saying, you know, take X to treat Y, because I see the limitations in that approach. I'm saying, let's see what the underlying reasons are, why the adrenals are not working, why the hormones are not working, why the thyroid isn't working, why blood sugar can't be controlled. So I'm going really, really deep to find out the solutions. And I can tell you, it's very complicated. It's very new for people, but it is very scientific. So fortunately, I have a way to measure change as biochemistry improves in the body, and my clients feel the change. And sometimes by that, it's the detox can be very, very difficult. My program, on a scale of 1 to 10, my program is a 10 out of 10 in terms of how difficult it is. And that includes not just the compliance that's required and the patience that's required, is that when the sodium and the potassium are moving towards the healthy ratio and levels, now the body has some energy to kick out stored metals. And so as the detoxification starts happening, people can have extreme symptoms, you know, debilitating headaches, more depression, more fatigue, skin rashes, more pain in their body. So, and these are all good signs, but they are extremely uncomfortable signs. And so that's why my clients all do the coffee enemas and what are known as the near-infrared saunas, is because I want to make sure people have a soft landing, and that when the metals are being stirred up, thanks to the supplements I use, now that these, you know, this hornet's nest is released, that the metals are not just circulating through the body, they must also find a way out. And that means they must come out through the bile, and they must come out through the skin in order so that you're not completely debilitated with the detox symptoms.
Well, truly. I mean, you know, like y'all will hear, let's see, it's today is day six. So tomorrow is Dr. Hal Huggins. He's really the Yoda, as I call him, of biological dentistry. He's the modern grandfather of biological or holistic dentistry. And Dr. Hal talks about really having to be careful with detoxification, because detoxification often becomes retoxification if our elimination pathways are not, our detox pathways are not flowing well. Thus, your strong emphasis on coffee enemas and saunas, right, Pam?
Right. It's the least expensive, most powerful way to deal with the detoxification. When people have, for example, and they'll email me and say, Pam, I have a copper headache. As the copper starts to come out, they get a very distinctive, what we call copper headache, and it hurts. It's very painful. It's very uncomfortable. And then they immediately go do a coffee enema and cause and effect. After they're done the enema, if they have a good elimination, very often the headache is gone. Because they've stimulated bioproduction. That's one of the exit routes for the copper to take, and they get relief almost instantaneously, and very few things can do that.
Right.
So it's a powerful, powerful tool, and more. It's getting more and more popular. People are starting to catch on to the importance of coffee enemas. At first, you know, some people tread very lightly. You know, they don't like the idea, but most of my clients are going to tell you, you know, as soon as they start getting used to doing the coffee enemas, there's just no going back. They always say to me, you know, I wish I had known about coffee enemas 10, 20, 30, 40 years ago.
Right. Perfect.
So
let's take it to this lady, Alika here, or Ayika, excuse me. I have chronic fatigue syndrome, fibromyalgia, and candida overgrowth. Besides excluding sugar and being on a Weston Price type diet, what's safe to do while nursing? And I'll chime in on this after you, Pam, because I've got something in particular to say here too.
Well, I work with a lot of women who have had children. I have quite a few clients right now, actually, who are pregnant and doing my program. And it's possible to do my program and be pregnant or even nurse. But in terms of the biochemistry, I know a lot of people say that, you know, I have to go in and kill my candida, get rid of my parasites, get rid of my H. pylori. That's really, to me, the wrong approach, because I've never really seen a lot of results by saying I want to go in and kill candida or kill parasites or what have you. And the reason why is because in order to truly keep these organisms under control, it's very important to essentially smother them out by making sure you have friendly organisms growing in your gut that are going to overpower the not so healthy organisms, and secondly, in order to help control, you know, candida, parasites, and so on, what's really important is that zinc and copper must be in the correct ratio, and that is what is very difficult to do. You can't just take zinc and copper and expect to, you know, get your zinc and copper in balance. That's why my program is five prongs, because one of the things we have to do is make sure we're balancing blood sugar by intaking enough animal fat in the diet throughout the day, breakfast, lunch, and dinner. That's just help stabilize the blood sugar. And resting is crucial on the program as well, because I tell my clients, those adrenal glands are damaged. You know, they're broken, and they need fixing. So imagine them in a cast like you've broken an arm or a leg, and that they, in order to heal, they must be in a state of rest as much as possible over the course of the day. So to get these systems turned back on again, it does take a tremendous amount of discipline.
Yeah.
Anyway, you were going to chime in on that too, eh?
Yeah. What I wanted to touch in on was there seems to be a strong correlation between candida overgrowth and amalgams in the mouth. So you know, this has just kind of been stumbled into over the years of people doing biological dentistry. You know, and Dr. Hal, again, without risking stealing his thunder, because frankly, there's no way I could, he talks about the marriage between metals and microbes, and how dental metals it's his perspective, and I mean, the guy's been at it for 50 years, cultivating this very biased, very opinionated, very educated opinion, that it's his opinion that the metals in the mouth have a very much of a causal influence on a lot of problems in the system.
Oh, he's right. He's right. The things like mercury are going to encourage dysbiosis, if you will, right? So in an ideal world, it would be nice if people didn't have, you know, mercury fillings. But the key thing is we have to ask ourselves, why is the mercury being held onto? And right. Natasha Campbell McBride talks about these lab rats and exposing them to mercury. One had strong intestinal flora. The other had weakened intestinal flora. And when the two lab rats were exposed to mercury, the one with weakened intestinal flora was the one who held on to the mercury. Sure. The lab rat with the strong intestinal flora was able to let go of, I think, 98% of it or something right. along that line.
So, and so once again, we're brought back to this whole point, and this seems to be a recurring theme in all the Q&A sessions, is it comes down to gut permeability and gut health.
Right. And so you want to make sure, again, bile is still a big part of the puzzle, because bile is crucial in terms of creating peristalsis. I know a lot of people think that constipation is due to a fiber deficiency. Well, it's not. It has to do with the bile production. We should be producing a lot of bile every day. And because of the low-fat lie, which began predominantly in the 1970s, that's what's led to a lot of digestive distress. And so if we're not able to produce enough bile, and of course, remember, dietary cholesterol is one of the building blocks to create the bile. You also must be drinking enough water, like I said earlier, not too much water, but say 4 glasses of water a day. So you need some components in place in order to produce bile. And so that way, that's another exit route for these excess metals. I mean, keep in mind, we have been exposed to heavy metals since the dawn of civilization. Right. So something has gone wrong in recent history as to why we're not able to let go of these metals. And part of it is this perfect storm where we are exposed to more metals than ever before in the history of mankind. But the other part of the perfect storm is that we have just lost the ability for our bodies to be able to kick these metals out.
Right, right. Well, folks, I appreciate, you know, I know you're here to hear both Pam Killeen and Victor Zinus. Unfortunately, I think Dr. Zinus is hitting a technical roadblock getting him on here. I'm sorry about that. Well, we're getting tons of gems here with Pam, so I'm thrilled with this. Let's just roll on. Oh yeah, we did. My wife was just reminding me here. It's a really good point. You know, we did originally have this summit scheduled for the middle of November, and then we delayed it. We postponed it because of Hurricane Sandy, and we just felt, you know, let's just respect the people in the Northeast and, you know, what they're going through, and got a lot of thank yous for that. Well, incidentally, Victor Zinus lives in upstate New York, and as you know, during the storms there, his dental office burned to the ground. So he's actually part of the collateral damage, if you will, of the storm. That I'd love to have him on here to be able to tell you his story.
Oh, that's so sad. Oh, yeah. That's horrible. I didn't know that.
Yeah. So got a number of questions here, people wrapping it all together here. If I can put it into one, they're basically asking, well, let me just throw you a few of them together here. Pam recommended a diet with 70% fat and only 20% protein and 10% carb. What would a typical meal with 70% fat look like? And then another question here from Patricia saying, what is your typical daily diet? That's what I want to hear is, I want to hear a breakfast, lunch, and dinner from Pam.
Right. Well, I mean, I love my eggs. Very commonly in the morning, I might have like a raw egg smoothie. So I go to my farmer and I get pasture-raised eggs. I get my farm fresh kefir, farm fresh yogurt, and maybe some coconut milk, a little bit of fruit, a tiny bit of maybe maple syrup, so I don't go too heavy on the carbs. But it's certainly got lots of brain nutrients in there and some really good fats, and that might be a breakfast for me. Or I might cook my eggs, too. I don't insist that everybody eat raw eggs. You know, we all enjoy omelets and quiche, for example, scrambled eggs. I don't mind if people want to eat their eggs that way. I just want people to eat foods that are most familiar to them and make sure that they are tasty. So there's a lot of food fanatics out there telling people to eat foods a certain way, and you may not enjoy foods a certain way. Some people are completely turned off by the idea of making, you know, a raw egg smoothie. So please don't feel like you have to do that if it's something that doesn't appeal to you. So certainly eggs for breakfast in the morning. I'll eat bacon, I'll eat sausages. And then, you know, you're sort of, my lunch and my dinner might be, and I'm no Martha Stewart, don't get me wrong. my diet is very, very basic. So I might have some steak and, you know, I might have a potato, but I don't eat a lot of potato. I'm Irish, of course, so, you know, tubers are part of my ancestral diet.
Right.
But I certainly don't eat a lot of tubers. But it's a good vehicle for me to eat more butter, some high-fat sour cream, perhaps some more bacon. It's the same thing as the way I look at eating sourdough bread, for example. I use it as an excuse to eat more butter or high-fat cheese.
Yeah.
my diet is very, very basic. I don't insist on, you know, a lot of fancy foods in my clients' diet. I don't want people, you know, being a slave in the kitchen, if you will. So what I've done is on my homepage, because this is such a common question, Will, is what I've done is I've consolidated a lot of the links for menu and meal ideas from the Weston A. Price Foundation. They're just on pamcolleen.com. And I have lots and lots of links there to give people menu and meal ideas so that they don't feel completely stuck. But certainly I have a lot of lamb in my diet. I love lamb, fish. You know, I eat a lot of red meat. And if I can get my food from wild or grass-fed sources, that's obviously a goal, but I don't insist on it in terms of my client base simply because I'm dealing with people who sometimes have very limited budgets or limited availability, and I don't want people to feel guilty if they can't get pasture-raised sources. So at a minimum, shop at the inner or the outer periphery of a grocery store and try and avoid lean cuts of meat. Make sure you have chicken skin on your chicken, turkey. If you are eating lean meats, maybe you want to cook them in butter or lard or tallow to give yourself a little extra fat that will help your digestion and assimilation. So, you know, in a nutshell, I just stick with these very basic foods.
Yeah. And I think that, you know, if we follow our true palate, if we follow what our taste buds really say, I mean, without, you know, you obviously have to be very considerate of the fact that we were all raised as sugar junkies. And so we have an exacerbated desire for sugar in our culture. You know, you're going to hear a lot more from us about this because there's really a very holistic approach to this as far as our sugar addiction. It goes well beyond the mouth. It's a cultural thing as well. But really, I think that if we follow our palates from the standpoint, I mean, if you're going to have a steak that isn't a fatty steak, then what do you do to make that steak taste better? You put a pat of butter on it. I mean, that just makes the steak richer, and you're like, oh, yum. So, I mean, we've said for years that having bread is just an excuse to get more butter in the diet, and I agree with that.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. So it's just a matter of being able to try and imagine those black and white shows before World War II. You know, the Leave It to Beavers, My Three Sons, whatever, all of these classic old TV shows or movies. And imagine what they would have sat down and eaten at breakfast, lunch, and dinner. Because before World War II, you know, we didn't have bacon phobia, butter phobia, egg phobia, red meat phobia, liver phobia. We didn't have any of those food phobias before World War II. And back then, we were much healthier, both physically and mentally. Now, I'm just using that as a ballpark era, because it was after World War II where things went from bad to worse. But before World War II, we had a chance to be healthy. But unfortunately, the edible oil industry was on the rise. The sugar industry was on the rise. But things went from bad to worse after World War II.
Right. Yeah. Perfect. Okay. Let's see. This is like, you know, coming back into this water quagmire here. What do you think of distilled water that is subsequently remineralized?
I don't recommend it. I don't. Distilled water is hungry water, and you've still changed the molecular structure of the water through the distillation process, so it's probably not going to hydrate you very well anyway, even if you do add salt to it. So again, the gold standard is really about making sure you're getting water from as close to a natural state as possible. And I know, like you said, it's a quagmire. This is not an easy question to answer. Everybody's going to have different comfort levels with regards to the answer. Yeah. You know, if I'm working with somebody, for example, who is on a very limited budget and I ask them to buy bottled water, you know, it may not be completely realistic for some people.
Yeah.
So this answer that I give you is going to have to be individualized based on your comfort levels.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you got to make it fit. You got to make it work.
The tap water, you know, and then as you know, the your regular sort of Brita filters, they're not going to get rid of things like fluoride. And it is a priority to avoid artificial water fluoridation. That's a huge priority.
It is. It is. And thankfully out here in the islands, we were effective in stopping water fluoridation. I say we as a state, we weren't back here yet, but I'm to understand that actually David Kennedy and his wife flew out here to help support that fight here in the state to maintain our water free of the silica fluoride.
Artificial water,
it's totally insane.
You know, and you're a great mentor, an example of what activism can do. I think it's unacceptable that the city water supplies are selling us water that's as dirty as it is. I think that more activism is required because really, quite honestly, Will, the answer is that we should be getting clean water, safe water from our taps. And that's not what we're getting. So really, that's what most people should be focusing on, is banding together throughout all of North America, for that matter, so that we can, city by city, clean up our water supplies. And this is going to take a tremendous amount of grassroots activism, because the city councilors here in where I live in London, Ontario, for the most part, the city councilors are completely deaf on the issue.
Right. More questions on water here. And again, this is... I know that this is kind of banging up against what one of our cultural, not really cultural, but our health food cultural paradigms here. This person is saying, are you recommending just four glasses of water per day, regardless of body weight? I've heard to consume half the body weight in ounces per day. Furthermore, drink half of this amount within the first 4 hours of waking to rehydrate the body. You want to touch on this? I don't want to spend a lot more of the time on this, but you want to...
No, the people need to drink, I'm saying on an average person, average height and so on, four glasses a day. That figure has to change based on size, based on one's activity. But again, the reason why I say about four glasses on average, depending on the individual, is because so many of my clients who have copper toxicity are not thirsty at all, or they're not hungry. They actually have to sit down and force themselves to have breakfast, lunch, and dinner.
Right.
That's essentially what anorexia is, basically copper toxicity. But that's the true, you know, sense of anorexia today is a marriage of some of the social cues that are coming as well. So it's a combination of things in terms of some of these very severe cases of anorexia. But biochemically speaking, you know, when I look at these people, they have copper toxicity. But you don't have to be skinny and have anorexia. You can be very overweight and have anorexia as well, and you'd be starving yourself because there's no appetite, and it has to do with the copper toxicity.
But I see. The
same thing happens with water. So these people are forcing themselves to have breakfast, lunch, and dinner because they have to in order to regulate their blood sugar and take the stress off the adrenal glands. But the other thing that they don't have is they don't have a cue for thirst. So I need to give them some figure to work with in terms of drinking water through the day. So four glasses is simply a ballpark. So if somebody's bigger, absolutely, they may need more. If somebody's smaller, they're going to drink less. But my point is, if there is no cue for thirst, you're going to have to maybe carry some water around with you and think about, consciously think about drinking water.
Sure.
that can be a chore with some of my clients.
Sure. This is a great one here from Colleen. What do you suggest for those who are allergic or sensitive to dairy, or those who are lactose intolerant?
Oh, no, that's a great question. Typically, when my clients switch to farm fresh dairy, they're usually fine. They tolerate the dairy. But certainly the commercial dairy is problematic for a lot of people. Not necessarily for everybody. It really depends on the strength of their digestive system. The problems with dairy stem from a couple of things. Number one, the cows are not fed the correct food. Cows are ruminant animals. They should be fed grass. So by giving cows food that is foreign to them, this is going to change the quality of the milk, and not for the good, of course. So that's the number one problem with commercial dairy products today. The other problem with commercial dairy products is, of course, that they have been pasteurized, nuclearized, killerized. I mean, it's just not recognizable. It's a liquid white chalk by the time it ends up on the grocery store shelf. So again, that's going to, because it's not in its natural state, this could lead to a lot of digestive issues. And finally, because of the low-fat lie, if you think about the beneficiaries of the low-fat lie, one group out there that has benefited the most from the low-fat lie has been the dairy industry, because the dairy industry knows the more they separate their product, the more money they make. So it was just a boon for the the dairy industry to be able to sell skim milk, for example.
Sure.
And this became super popular, of course, mostly starting in the 1970s. And so when you reduce fat, this in dairy products, this is going to lead to a lot of digestive problems, a lot of cramping, pains, aches, and so on. So there's at least three reasons why people are having trouble with dairy. It's not necessarily that people are allergic to dairy or lactose intolerant. That may be how things manifest. But as soon as people switch to farm fresh raw dairy, they tend to be fine. They also must restore their digestive system. They have to still strengthen their digestion as well. And so, you know, my clients all know three square meals is the baseline to be able to contribute to a healthy biochemistry. But I also ask my clients to focus on eating certain foods that help support digestion as well. And that includes your lacto-fermented foods like raw sauerkraut, like pickles, and ideally the lacto-fermented form of pickles, things like kefir and yogurt. These are all foods that I think people should be consuming on a regular basis, on a daily basis, in order to help support the digestive tract. So that's my short answer on the dairy question.
Yeah.
The other thing is that if people don't want to drink milk, that's fine. That's fine. But certainly the lacto-fermented dairy like yogurt and kefir are usually much easier on the digestive system when people are transitioning over. Some people do have trouble on far fresh raw milk at first, but as they start with the fermented forms of dairy, they usually do pretty well.
Yeah, totally. Here's a question from Melissa for you. Do you have a specific test you run to test hormones on your program?
No, and I don't really need to do that. Because I'm not a big fan of the bioidentical hormones, and that's for a couple of reasons. One is because the bioidentical hormones don't solve the underlying reason why the hormones are out of balance in the first place. And secondly, the bioidentical hormones, there's a risk in terms of increasing your chances of developing cancer. So I'm not a big fan of the bioidentical hormones. For the hormones to work properly, the minerals need to be in their correct ratios. So, for example, I work with a lot of people who have little to no libido. As the zinc and the copper go into balance, I notice that's when their libido kicks in. So it has a lot to do with the minerals. And as I mentioned earlier, that's a tricky thing to restore in somebody. But I mean, bioidentical hormones are, you know, usually not going to help people in the long run.
Right.
Maybe people who've had body parts removed, that might be a place for them, but...
Right.
For people who come to me and they think they're hypothyroid or they think they're, you know, low testosterone, things like that. No, once the minerals go back into balance, that's when the hormones tend to kick back in again.
Okay, perfect. And this one, I think you'll have a really fun time thrashing it. what do you think about intermittent fasting?
Right, I used to do that. No, I don't recommend fasting. I know it's a really popular thing right now. But I know that when we ate three square meals, well, we were healthy. You know, when we ate three square meals, we were healthy. And food fads surface because they're trying to convince us that what they're selling us, even if it's an idea, that it's healthy. But I know that when we ate three square meals, we were healthy. So when people do fasting, and I'm guilty of it, I used to do fasting. You know, I was already starving to begin with. You know, I was already starving at a cellular level in terms of my nutrient profile. So, you know, intentionally starving myself for a fasting period just added insult to injury. Secondly, of course, most people today have very dysregulated blood sugar, and so, you know, fasting again is just going to potentially disrupt the blood sugar even more. And there's another reason why I don't like fasting, and it has to do with the bile production. You know, the bile wants to be produced three times a day. You know, we eat and we have words, breakfast, lunch, and dinner, for a reason, right? We have these words in our vocabulary for a reason, because we eat breakfast, lunch, and dinner. In general, we basically evolved to eat breakfast as soon as we woke up in the morning, lunch 5 hours later, dinner 5 hours after that. So the bile is expecting food essentially every 5 hours over the course of a waking day. Right, and so you want, and if the body isn't getting food or the right kind of food, this is going to impair bile production. So the long-term problem with doing too much fasting is that you can also impair liver, gallbladder function as well. So I'm not a big fan. I don't believe in suffering anymore. I used to do juice fasting and, you know, all of these types of things, and I just eat 3 square meals a day. That's all I do.
Right. Which, I mean, like you said, when we spoke months ago, if you just go back to 3 squares, that's a lot right there just to get things rolling in the right direction, it seems like.
It is. It's one of the most fundamental things somebody can do for their health. But yeah. You have no idea what kind of struggle it can be when I'm dealing with people who have copper toxicity, no appetite. You know, it's a very difficult thing to get some people to do.
Right. I'm scanning to see if there's just we got a bunch more questions here, but I'm looking to see if I can narrow it down to some real crucial ones here. This is a great one, and I think that this would be a fun one. I wanted to have Dr. Zinus on this call because I think that you guys would have slightly different, if not strongly different, perspectives on some of this stuff, which would be fun to kind of have each of your opinions here so that everybody on the show realizes that there is no right answer, and that we really have to navigate this on our own and get the help that resonates with us. Here's a question from Facebook, actually all the way from Colombia. One question: it seems as though Ms. Colleen suggests a more acidic environment in the stomach. However, from everything I've heard, we should want a more alkaline environment. Can someone clarify this for me? And I don't think that she's referring to stomach acidity here, but as far as food balance.
No, I mean the stomach. The stomach is supposed to be as acidic as battery acid.
True.
And so what happens is when the biochemistry goes awry and things like sodium fall out of balance and zinc falls out of balance, now you don't have the raw materials to produce enough hydrochloric acid in the stomach. So the stomach acid is compromised. It starts to move towards a more alkaline pH.
Right.
And so when you eat food, things like protein are not going to be broken down into their amino acids as effectively. You're going to have a lot of indigestion, bloating, gas, you know, burping, etc. You're going to have a lot of symptoms because you're not producing enough hydrochloric acid in your stomach.
Right.
And so when I know this is biochemical, so and biochemistry doesn't come back overnight. It takes months and months and months to get the digestive system back running again. So what I ask for people to do while their biochemistry is trying to be restored is I ask people to cheat, essentially, to retrain the stomach to be acidic by eating foods that we know to be acidic, like lemon water, raw sauerkraut, pickles, kefir, yogurt, right? We want to retrain the gut to be acidic. And see, the alkaline theory comes from my former past, you know, my past, my history in terms of being a raw food vegan. I used to believe, you know, take all these green foods and you're going to be alkaline and cancer can't live in an alkaline environment and so on. And this is an extremely flawed theory, of course. Now that I understand minerals and mineral balancing, I see how specific it is that the cells need to be maintained within a correct pH, but this is based upon the balance of some very, very key minerals. And you can't balance these minerals by eating an alkaline diet. In fact, the people who come to me who have been eating an alkaline diet become too alkaline. They suffer with something called alkalosis. And they're not very healthy people. My ancestors were Irish and Scottish, and I can assure you, they ate a lot of acid foods. and they were very, very healthy.
Yeah. Boy, you have to deal with a lot of hate mail I'm seeing from these questions.
Oh, I'm the most hated woman in Canada. I have enemies at Health Canada. I have enemies at, you know, big food, big pharma. The vegetarians hate me. The vegans hate me. No, I'm the most hated woman in Canada. I'm terrible. I mean, I'm so used to it. But, you know, I was one of them.
Right.
I was terribly, when I was a vegetarian, I really, really thought I knew a lot about nutrition. And
that makes it that much more of a heretic situation, Pam. You used to be one of them.
There's three great books from recovering vegetarians. You know, there's The Vegetarian Myth by Lear Keith. There's The Meat Fix by John Nicholson, and Beyond Broccoli by Susan Schenk. And I have them all on my books page as well. If people are questioning vegetarianism, certainly they want to read these three books. But I get to see it every single day. Well, when most of my clients are recovering vegetarians. They were either near vegetarian, or vegan. And I can tell you the copper toxicity issue is a huge problem with these people. And they're struggling with tremendous problems with regards to no libido, low libido, memory problems, sleep problems, anxiety problems, depression, fatigue, infertility issues, and sadly, Will, this is what I have to see. It's tragic beyond tragic, but the women who were vegetarian or vegan and happened to get pregnant, I have to see the tragedy of this malnutrition in the babies. And you know, this is my experience. This is what I'm seeing. So it would be very difficult for me to endorse a vegetarian diet based on what I see every single day.
So I know that we're on the hour here, and I want to respect that time. And yet I'd love to ask a couple more questions if you're okay with that, Pam.
Sure, that'd be fine.
I have one here that from Marla that just came in that I'd be curious to hear your take on this. And I don't know if there's really an answer that to be found, but she asks, how can I encourage my 12-year-old daughter not to be a vegetarian?
Well, I would certainly read the three books I just mentioned.
Yeah.
I just had an email conversation with a woman who followed Skinny Bitch. You know that book? Skinny Bitch, which a lot of the teenage girls are reading and unfortunately listening to. Well, this is a documentary filmmaker, and she listened to Six Skinny Bitch. She followed their guidelines, and she got very, very sick, and now she's doing a documentary.
Wow.
She's not too happy. She's not too happy with the misinformation in that book.
Great.
And neither am I. So I do what I can to warn vegetarians, but as I tell them, you know, I tell my clients, I say, you know, just let them learn the hard way. I had to learn the hard way. They're going to have to learn the hard way.
Yeah.
But for a teenage girl, if she's listening to her peers at school, if they're reading the book Skinny Bitch, you know, it's the power of the peer persuasion, if you will. But to the books I just mentioned, The Vegetarian Myth, The Meat Fix, Beyond Broccoli, those three books are books you probably want to read.
There you go. Perfect. Okay, Pam Killeen, where can people find more about you?
They can just go to my website, www.pamkillen.com. That's K-I-L-L-E-N.com. And I do have a few Facebook pages. I encourage people to go to my multimedia page, and they can listen to a lot of radio interviews that I've done. And certainly I have a lot of references on my books page as well. So I try to put as much helpful information for people there as possible.
Big time. I remember when I first listened to your presentation at Sean Croxton's Real Food Summit, I was blown away. I'm like, oh my gosh, this lady is making so much sense. And the light bulbs went off for me. I said, okay, I'm going to contact her about our summit we've got coming up.
No, it was such a pleasure, you know, being involved in the summit. And congratulations to you and Susan for putting on such a fantastic event. Honestly, I know how much you've been working at this. And, you know, it's just been months and months and months of you know, hard work for you and a lot of stress with technical problems and so on, but you've pulled it off nicely, and a big congratulations to both of you.
Thanks so much, Pam. I mean, we love the position of being able to just be the messenger. I mean, without folks like you here really dropping the gems, we'd be just, you know, hollow marketing screaming about nothing. So thank you for bringing the goods to the program here.
Oh, it's been a pleasure. I appreciate it.
Right on, folks. Tomorrow is day 7. That'll wrap up the summit for us. We're bringing in, we've saved Dr. Hal Huggins for last. So by all means, you definitely want to check out what he's got to say as he just unrolls his, what I think, over 50 years now of experience of being the most controversial dentist on the planet. Thank you very much, Pam, and we'll catch you all at the summit. Aloha.